NBC Monitor News on the Hour. Here's Lou Wood.
In Korea, a U.S. medical evacuation helicopter carrying soldiers wounded in a clash with North Korean troops crashed tonight, killing 7 persons, most of them Americans. The men were casualties from a shooting exchange along the demilitarized zone, which the U.S. command said occurred when the North Koreans fired on a 10-man work detail, putting up United Nations demarcation markers inside the zone. Meanwhile, a heavy snow has forced a 24-hour postponement of tomorrow's joint U.S.-South Korean military exercise, in which American paratroopers were to have been dropped only 80 miles from the Korean demilitarized zone. The exercise, called Operation Focus Retina, included units of the 82nd Airborne Division, flown 8,500 miles from North Carolina. It was billed as the longest airborne assault operation in history. North Korea has condemned it as provocative, and even some Japanese are irked because one American unit was to land in Okinawa. In Vietnam, enemy rockets hit downtown Saigon and an oil refinery in its suburbs early Sunday. One warehouse guard was wounded, and the oil fire was brought under control within an hour. In earlier action, the Viet Cong shelled 70 bases and towns throughout South Vietnam, the most extensive attack of their current offensive. An appropriate response to the enemy shelling of population centers that President Nixon warned of in his news conference yesterday was undoubtedly discussed today at a meeting he held with the National Security Council. No details of the meeting were given, but Defense Secretary Laird, just back from a first-hand look at the Vietnam situation, attended. Gerard Smith, the U.S. disarmament envoy, also was at the meeting. Smith leaves tonight for Geneva with a new set of American proposals for the 17-nation disarmament conference, which reconvenes Tuesday. The Soviet delegate is already in Geneva and has made conciliatory statements. Earlier today, the president dropped in on a luncheon of the National Alliance of Businessmen in Washington and urged private employers to concentrate on job placement programs for unemployed youth. Another speaker at the Businessmen's Alliance was Whitney Young, executive director of the National Urban League, who drew an analogy between urban aid programs and the president's recent decision to go ahead with an anti-ballistic missile system.
I was certain I had said on the phone to the administrations in the last 4 or 5 years that what we needed was a domestic Marshall Plan, not a domestic missile plan. But I suppose, being realistic, we have to have, and I'm not opposing it, some type of modified defense against external threat. But I submit to you that if we don't have a comparable kind of expenditure and plan against the internal threat in this society, then the external threat will loom to be almost insignificant.
Whitney Young of the National Urban League. Informed sources at the United Nations say that U.S., Soviet, British, and French U.N. ambassadors will meet secretly during the coming week to discuss the Middle East crisis. That report followed a meeting today between U.N. Secretary General Thant and Abba Eban, Israel's foreign minister. Eban has repeated several times during a visit to the United States this week that only the Arab nations and Israel can settle their dispute, and outside pressure will not solve the problem. During the past week, a special Senate committee on malnutrition has been making on-the-spot investigations of hunger in the United States, especially in the Southeast. Today, Herbert Klein, President Nixon's director of communications, told a young Republican leadership school in Washington that the committee was trying to make a political issue out of hunger. The committee's chairman, Senator George McGovern, a South Dakota Democrat, replied,
"Mr. Klein has been around long enough to know that in order to get action on an important problem of this kind, it's necessary to turn the public spotlight on it. Our committee is a bipartisan committee. There has been no partisan politics whatsoever in the activities of the Senate Select Committee. Members of both political parties have been represented in these hearings and in the investigation from the very beginning."
Senator George McGovern. The world's largest tugboat missing since last Tuesday has been sighted near Bermuda and is due to dock there tonight. The Moran Towing Company in New York told the Coast Guard cutter that their ocean-going tug, the Alice Moran, finally radioed she was okay after not having been heard from since Tuesday. Apparently, her radio was out of order. Radio station WIOD in Miami says that the master of a Liberian freighter with a reported mutiny aboard has denied there is any mutiny on his ship. The captain told the Florida Coast Guard he could not account for the mutiny story. and another Liberian freighter apparently sank in the Gulf of Mexico early today after radioing an SOS. The Coast Guard is searching for her 34 crewmen. Once again, the hour's top story. A U.S. medical evacuation helicopter carrying soldiers wounded in a clash with North Korean troops crashed near Seoul tonight, killing 7 persons, most of them American. Lou Wood, NBC News, reporting.
Listen again on the hour for NBC Monitor News. From the bawdy Broadway show, Canterbury Tales, the wife of Bath, played by the Gabrielli Brass. You know, one of the unusual stories of this week occurred when a famous movie star volunteered to play a difficult real-life role. We'll find out what it is and why he decided to do it right after Hugo Montenegro shakes us all up with good vibrations.
I love the colorful clothes she wears and the way the sunlight plays upon her hair. She must be kind.
Vibration to the 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 vib vibrations are happening. Gotta keep them from the good vibrations are happening.
It was announced this week that actor Tony Curtis will be the national chairman of the I Quit campaign, a new anti-smoking drive of the American Cancer Society. Monitor's Barbara Walters asked Tony to explain the personal reasons behind his acceptance of the controversial assignment.
Tony Curtis has recently announced that he will be chairman of the I Quit Smoking campaign. He has deep personal reasons for quitting smoking, and I'd like to ask Tony Curtis what they are.
My father died at an early age because of cigarette smoking, and there was no doubt about it, you know. It's simply a fact that if you smoke cigarettes, it's going to hurt you. It can hurt you physically. Now, that's the thing we must campaign against. I gave it up very simply. I bought a book one day on cigarette smoking and cancer. And after I got through about 4 or 5 pages, I just quit because I saw the facts right in front of me. And then I liked my father very much. He was a fabulous man, and I used to have wonderful times with him. I didn't really know him very well as a kid because he was really breaking his back trying to make a living for the family, my mother, my brother, myself, when we were children, you know? And the only pleasure I really remember of my father having was in the later years when I started to become successful. He enjoyed that, and I was able to take care of him. Got him a car. He moved to California. Didn't have to work as much, you know? And during the years that my father and I should have become good friends, he died. How unfortunate for him and for me, you know? And it's as simple as that.
Tony, you said at one point, look, if adults smoke, okay, that's their poison. But you really care about the kids.
They're the ones that really emulate and kind of imitate. We all do that.
I guess if daddy smokes, kids smoke.
They
and
should.
If, and if Tony Curtis smokes in movies or off screen, then the thousands of Tony Curtis admirers will. This means that you'll never light a cigarette on screen, I gather.
Never. I will light a cigarette if the cigarette is a character piece of business that shows the destruction of the person. Let us say if I'm going to play a harried or a nervous young or whatever executive somewhere, and if a cigarette in my hand or mouth dangling from it will help intensify the feeling of his agitation, I would consider it. But I would not consider it as an elegant piece of business in a scene. I would never smoke. I haven't. I started to smoke cigars and pipes after that, which are much better, incidentally. I'd like to talk with some tobacco companies to see if they can invent a cigar for women. You know, I know there are a few on the market, but you see, women have the same problem as men. As a matter of fact, they're noticing much more lung cancer and heart disease in women than before because women started smoking later than men. You notice how it all catches up? I mean,
they didn't used to be.
No, women never smoked as much as men.
But the statistics were so low for women.
Exactly. It always looked as if they were immune, but they're not.
I think it's a matter of public relations, really, Tony, that somehow to smoke a cigar if you're a woman means that you're either very masculine or a kook.
Right.
And if it could get to the point where, you know, doesn't everybody,
I agree
or
with
maybe
you,
even a cute little pipe or something.
But don't you think that that's the harbinger of things to come in our country today? That's why I love the fashion.
Listen, if we can wear pantsuits, exactly.
But that's the point. I mean, why should a cigar be masculine or not feminine or what? I mean, who is the guy that says that's tough looking, that's butch, and that isn't? I mean, that's nonsense.
Well, good luck, Tony. But can you imagine that day when a husband comes home, finds a cigar in the living room ashtray, and his wife tells him the girls were over for the afternoon? Here's Paul Anka.
Show me. precious love will be forged. The light, love me again with all your might. A still
neighbors, including music by Spanky and Our Gang, Booker T and the MGs, and Andy Williams, right here on the Monitor Beacon.
Okay, boys, let's hear it for Mr. Young.
Yay! Mr.
Young is practically supporting us single-handed. Listen to this. Last week, he left his house dark.
We knew he was out, so we moved in. So to speak, that is.
Cost him his TV set and hi-fi. We love you, Mr. Young.
Yeah!
And this week, I know what he did. He cashed his paycheck and kept it all at home instead of in a bank.
And then he didn't double lock his door.
So we moved in again.
We love you, Mr. Young.
Yeah, Mr. Young, yeah.
And his neighbors didn't dial 911 to report anything funny going on.
That's funny.
Keep it up, folks. Keep on ignoring those 10 burglary safeguards.
Yeah, support your local burglar. Why should he work as hard as you?
Operation Safe City.
WNBC, Radio 660, New York. A statistic for you, my friend. The Public Health Service announced that for each of the past 11 years, the number of marriages has risen and the birth rate has declined. I guess there's nothing like marriage to break up a good thing. Spanky and the Gang.
Stars.
With the Masters Golf Championship less than a month away, interest is building up concerning the chances of last year's winner to repeat. His win, you'll recall, was controversial, resulting from the famous scorecard incident. Here's a Monitor Sports report.
This is Kyle Rote for Monitor Sports, and my guest today on Monitor's open line is Bob Golby, the Masters Golf Champion. And Bob, you've had a whole year to live with your Masters victory. What kind of mail have you received since then?
Well, mostly good mail. I had a lot of good friends around the country, and everyone was very happy. After 12 years of playing the tour, everyone was happy that I won a major championship. But, of course, I had 200 or 300 letters that were from cranks or sportsmen who didn't think that I should have won because of the scorecard incident with Roberto, and seemed like the public sympathy was with Roberto and not with myself. But it was unfortunate the way it all happened. And it's one of those things, I guess, in sports.
One of the nice things, I understand, is the letter Bob Jones sent to you.
Well, I did get a nice letter from Bob Jones. He stated that it was unfortunate for Roberto, but equally so for me because it took away from the glory of a major championship that I should have had.
Bob, much has been written, of course, since the DeVincenzo incident, and all kinds of suggestions have been made to change the rules. Do you think that the rules should be changed?
Well, actually, as a player, I prefer to have the final jurisdiction over my scorecard, and I like the rule the way it is, and it's not only because I won the tournament that way. I believe the 95% of the touring pros feel the same way, and of course, the powers in golf have tried to come up with a better solution, but they just haven't at this time, and I don't believe we will get a better solution. The player himself seems to know more what he shot than anyone else, and he should sort of have the final say-so of the card when he puts his signature on it.
Well, we'll close the book on that and move on to this year's Masters, which, of course, gets underway on April 10th. When do you plan to go to Augusta?
Well, I'm actually going to play Greensboro Open the week before in Greensboro, North Carolina, and I plan to arrive at Augusta the Sunday night before the tournament.
Bob, the PGA, as you are well aware, has started a new system designed to speed up play. What's been your impression of that?
Well, I'm very pleased with this effort because myself, I play fairly fast, and I get a little nervous when I have to stand around and think too long about a particular shot. And I'm really happy that they're making some move. I believe we're playing twosomes the last couple of days now. And I'm sure that this might be a little influence of Mr. Dye, who's the new commissioner of golf, because he's always been a bug on slow play. And I'm sure happy about it.
Well, Bob, good luck in the Masters coming up on April 10th.
Thank you, Kyle, very much.
Bob Golby, whose next major assignment is defending his Masters Golf Championship on April 10th at Augusta, Georgia. And this is Kyle Rote for Monitor Sports.
And here are a few late results and items from the Monitor Sports desk. In exhibition baseball today, Washington snapped an 8-game losing streak and walloped Atlanta 18-5. Other scores, New York Yankees 6, Boston 5, Chicago White Sox 3, Los Angeles 2. It was Minnesota 2, Houston nothing. St. Louis 3, Cincinnati 2, New York Mets 5, Kansas City 3, Pittsburgh 7, Philadelphia 3. And listen to this, Arizona State University 5, Seattle 4. And did you see where Andy Williams and his lovely Claudine are expecting their third, which makes Andy's new record most appropriately named. Happy Heart.
There's a certain sound always follows me around. When you're close to me,
something Confucius didn't say. Man who sleep at wrong time, snore in face of opportunity.
I was driving through sometime around 3 o'clock at night. I had fallen asleep, and all of a sudden waking up and seeing myself in the left lane and seeing a semi-tractor trailer coming straight at me. I don't know what woke me up. Maybe it was the...
When you're tired, don't drive. When you're rested, but the monotony of driving makes you drowsy, pull over, take a break, and take 2 for the road. 2 no-dose action aids. They've got the strongest stimulant you can buy without a prescription, yet they're not habit-forming. No-dose action aids. No car should be without them.
Tight, Booker T and the MGs. But there's plenty of good listening time on Monitor, Booker T. And in northern Indiana and southern Michigan, the place to listen is WTRC Elkhart. I'm Ted Steele. And listen to this. If Monitor comes, can spring be far behind? I'm Ted Steele, and this weekend, as usual, we're going everywhere the action is, and with a special look at the plus and minus of our troubled postal system. Right now, here's Glenn Campbell singing zip code 77550. That's Galveston.
Galveston, oh Galveston, I still hear your sea winds blowing. I still see her dark eyes glowing. She was 21 when I left Galveston. Galveston, oh Galveston, I still hear your sea waves crashing. I clean my gun and dream of Galveston. I still see her standing by the water, standing there looking out to sea. And is she waiting there for me? Where we used to run. Galveston, oh Galveston, I am so afraid of dying. Before I dry the tears she's crying, before I watch your seabirds flying in the sun. Galveston.
couriers in ancient Rome used to make deliveries of messages by foot, and in the case of special deliveries, by chariot. But Monitor's survey of postal conditions here at home and around the world discovered that today a citizen of Rome gets his mail quicker than he can say Gina Lola Brigida, if that's what he wants to do. Take a letter, Rome.
There are really three postal systems on the Italian peninsula. The tiny republic of San Marino in northeast Italy puts out stamps as fast as collectors will buy them. It's the main industry for the 28 square mile sovereign country with its 14,000 inhabitants. Then there's the state of Vatican City. The Vatican publishes special sets for every papal trip for Christmas, Easter, and special occasions. This provides income for the Vatican, but its output has exceeded the demand. It was announced the other day that large quantities of excess stamps would be burned. This pleased collectors because it made their Vatican stamps rarer. Letters bearing San Marino stamps can be mailed only in San Marino, but those of the Vatican can be mailed anywhere in Italy. The Italian Post Office sends these over to the Vatican to receive the Vatican postmark. It's a nice friendly arrangement. Mail delivery within Italy is frequent and fast, except on those periodic occasions when underpaid employees go on strike. Usually, the strikes last no more than 48 hours. Afterwards, it takes several weeks to clear away the backlog. There's one quite original service. Streetcars and buses which terminate at the railroad station have a mail slot near the door. A Roman can drop a letter through this slot into a box. When the bus arrives at the railroad station, the letters are collected and dispatched without delay to the proper train or put on a bus to the airport. One diverting aspect of the Italian postal system is that the amount of postage needed on a postcard depends on how many words it carries. There's a low price for no more than 5 words of greeting. If there are more words, more stamps are required. Even with these gimmicks, the Italian post office is running in the black. But Italians complain about the periodic increases in the price of mailing a letter. Irving R. Levine, NBC News, Rome.
In Jerusalem, too, the postal tradition seems to have taken deep root, and neither snow nor rain nor gloom of night, etc., slows down the mails. But what about a 20-year hot and cold war? Take a letter, Jerusalem.
In a land whose population has quadrupled in 20 years, a land where new towns and villages have sprung up overnight, postal deliveries are sure and generally swift. In the past 2 years or less, the Ministry of Posts has risen to the additional challenge of serving the conquered Arab territories and integrating them into the postal system. Israel's Ministry of Posts handles more than mail. It also runs the telephone, telegraph, and telex services. And these services, too, have expanded like mad, but in an orderly rather than a mad fashion. The post office in Israel will do many things for the average Israeli. Wake him up at a set time in the morning, tell him what time it is, accept his checks for payment of all taxes, national and municipal, and put his money in a postal savings account and pay him interest. The Israeli Postal Service, of course, has its faults and problems, such as long waits at stamp counters and long waits for new telephones, but it works with a will to correct them, and the Israelis actually like the mailman. Alvin Rosenfeld, NBC News, Jerusalem.
And there'll be more mail calls, foreign and domestic, throughout the Monitor weekend. Here's Brenda Lee calling her own mail.
So he told you that you're the dream that he's been searching for. And he told you that you've never met anyone like you before. As Johnny one time. Did he tell you that your heart would soon become a trinket on his bracelet, a broken heart? Did he tell you that the morning sun would find you patching up your shattered pride and searching for the missing part? snow as Johnny one time. So he told you that he'd never leave your heart astray. And he told you that he'd love you forever and a day. And I can hear him telling you that he's the shine and that's what kind. Did it tell you snow has done one time? Oh, did he tell you that your heart soon become another trinket on his bracelet, a broken heart? And did he tell you that the morning sun will find you catching up your shattered pride, searching for the missing part?
Here are three big words: duty, honor, country. That's the credo of the United States Military Academy at West Point, 167 years old this weekend. And that certainly rates a salute. Here on the Monitor Beacon.
ABC Radio will put you in contact. The Sunday evening telephone show that invites you to discuss today's issues with three clergymen. This is Mike Moss. I'm your host. My guests are the Reverend James Crawford, Rabbi Mordecai Waxman, and Father Don Pryor. This week, our topic is medical transplants. Be in contact. Listen to and call WNBC Radio, Plaza 7, 8866, tomorrow night at 9:05.
Hello, Edna. It's me. I'm fine, considering my son Bernie just ruined his life. How? I'll tell you how in two words. The Peace Corps. Oh, Edna, such plans we had for him. You remember? But no, not my Bernie. He had to run off and save the world and live in a shack 10,000 miles away, working in a hospital, and he's an accountant. These kids nowadays, I just don't know. Oh, I gotta hang up, Edna. Search for Life is coming on. Bye.
WNBC, Radio 660, New York.
Monitor, I'm Ted Steele. And would you say it's appropriate on this weekend, when we're looking at some of the post office problems, that we resume our appointed rounds with a song by the Lettermen? I have dreamed. About what? Two deliveries a day?
I have dreamed that your arms are you'd be. I have dreamed every
Latest development in the fight against narcotics. Here reporting for Monitor, John Burns, noted authority on drug abuse.
The New York State Legislature has become increasingly concerned about the state's serious drug abuse problem. In 1966, the legislature created the Narcotic Addiction Control Commission to develop a program to rehabilitate narcotic addicts, conduct research into the drug problem, and to develop an education program to prevent drug abuse. This last year, the legislature added the Narcotic Guidance Council law to the books. This new law enables and encourages communities to form their own narcotic guidance councils to fight drug abuse problems on the local level. The chairman of the commission wrote to the mayors, supervisors, and other executive heads of nearly 600 cities, towns, and villages in the state, urging them to form these councils and to come to the State Narcotics Commission for advice and assistance. The feeling behind this legislation was best expressed by its sponsor, Assembly Speaker Perry B. Duryea, who explained the role he saw for each local council in these words. If we are to win the battle against drug abuse, we must extend our efforts to the new boundaries of the narcotics battlefield, the community social structure, the school, the neighborhood, and the home. In other words, we must involve every citizen of the New York State in an absolute effort to save our children from themselves. The law enables counties, towns, villages, and cities to create their own councils to spearhead community-wide attacks on the drug abuse problem. Both soft drugs like amphetamines, barbiturates, and marijuana, and hard drugs like heroin, opium, and morphine are targets in these community efforts. Each council can have 3 to 5 members, including a clergyman, an attorney, and a physician. These local drug councils seek to stimulate community prevention programs involving the secondary schools, colleges, churches, civic groups, and law enforcement agencies. The state helps each council by conducting training programs and leading school discussion programs, and by making available their extensive educational materials, including literature, films, and taped dialogues by ex-addicts. New York State has made an extensive commitment to the fight against drug abuse, and many other states are doing the same. But still, far too many states and local communities across the nation are hesitating about moving in strongly with the funds, programs, and plans needed for meeting the drug abuse problem head-on. The time is late, and the problem is begging for action and solution. This is John Burns for Monitor.
A man is alone from the day he's born to the dawn of his last goodbye. I need no God, I believe no dreams, and it seems that I've always known that we laugh and cry, that we hope and sigh, that we live and we die alone. I've got me, I've got rainbows. If I've got me, just to see how the rain goes away. 'Cause I got somebody who cares, someone who shares my company. Dump anything but pity on my plate. I'm standing straight now.
Results and comments from the Monitor Sports Desk in the NCAA basketball tournament. North Carolina won the Eastern Regional Final with an 87-85 victory over Davidson on Charlie Scott's 20-footer with 1 second to play. After the game, Davidson coach Lefty Drysdale said that he'll decide in the next 48 hours whether or not to accept the head coaching job at Maryland. In the Eastern consolation game, Duquesne 75, St. John's 72. Purdue won the Mid-Eastern Final 75-73 on Rick Mount's 20-footer with only 2 seconds left in overtime. Kentucky finished third with a 72-21 victory over Miami of Ohio. Drake captured the Midwestern Regional Final, downing Colorado State 84-77. In the consolation game, it was Colorado 97, Texas A&M 82. In the far Western Regional consolation, Weber State turned back New Mexico State 58-56. One on an important NCAA basketball tournament Western Regional Final. It was UCLA 90, Santa Clara 52. Raymond Postgate of London is the head of an organization that he calls the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to People Who Dine Out. And here's a couple of his suggestions on how to spot a bad restaurant. If the staff is inexpensively dressed, that means money not spent getting the best food. If the music is too loud, that means they're trying to keep your mind off their bad food and service. If the menu is filled with wordy descriptions of the food, that means the copywriter is paid more than the chef. Come on, Raymond. Who goes into a restaurant these days to eat, huh?
Very interesting. And at this time, can I offer my kindest and warmest regards to all of the McGillicuddies, the Sweeneys, the Gallagher's, and the Schatzmeyers. A happy St. Patrick's Day. Very interesting and exceedingly ethnic.
Thank you. Eugene Vess, a barber in Salem, Virginia, isn't laughing these days. He's closing his barbershop after 23 years because he says he can't tell the boys from the girls anymore. Come on, Eugene, it's easy. The ones with the necklaces are the boys.